Welcome to Truth Jihad Radio, the all-out struggle for truth, because the best jihad is a word of truth, flung in the face of an oppressor. I'm Kevin Barrett. I've been doing this since 2006, bringing on great guests, and I love to find new people who are worthy of this show. And we've got one today. That's David Noble. He is an attorney, an architect, a member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And he's written some amazing stuff, including some advice to President Trump. So without further ado, David, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and offer any necessary disclaimers?
Okay. It's true. I'm an attorney. I was a licensed architect up until this year. I retired my architect's license, so you have to say retired. Let me say this also. I send monthly letters to Donald Trump. I've been doing this since his initial announcement. And I take the position that as an attorney, when I talk with people about this, to do it on a professional level, I assume that they're potentially a professional client. So I use the attorney ethics, and I respect the attorney-client or potential client privilege. So it's up to them to repeat anything that's said because they're the holder of the privilege, and I, as attorney, don't repeat anything that any of them said except in a generic sense if it were, say, taken on my general impression of the dialogue. There are about 100 and some people who have asked to receive the copies of the monthly Trump letters, and the dialogue sometimes becomes a full-time effort. So anyhow, you've been reading the letters, Kevin. I blind carbon copy you, but nevertheless, you invited me to be on your show, and I thank you very much.
Well, you're very welcome, and I really like those letters. I saw that there are a couple of these attorneys groups that are looking into ways to get some legal action going on 9/11, and you're affiliated with them, and in one of them, the reaction from one guy in the group is that he urges you to tone it down, stop talking about who did 9/11, namely Israel and its American accomplices. Instead, just focus on demolition. He tells you that Trump is surrounded by Jewish people. His closest advisor is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. You're never going to get anywhere with this. So, I don't know. What's your response to that?
On that particular communication, I know which one you mean. He included you in his subgroup, so he waives any confidentiality as to that. But he's not the only one speaking in a general sense of the 100 and some people. A number of them are against me, but they want to keep informed so they can call and sometimes curse me out. So, and also, I used to have a security clearance myself. Part of my training was any group of five or more, you're bound to have a spy or somebody you can't trust. And even if it's just between you and me, I don't know.
I don't trust you, and I'm not sure about myself either.
Yeah, but an effort like this, because it's a potentially very explosive issue, it attracts people, and they're just not necessarily your friends. I assume everybody is objective and not out with a hidden agenda or out to hurt me in any way. But nevertheless, as an attorney, my skin is somewhat thick, and I've survived this long, so I don't think if they're going to get me by now, they're going to have to overcome a lot of experience.
Right. Well, I know that you're not necessarily going to agree with these people, although some of them could be troublemakers. But this person in particular, I think, is probably just repeating a position that's fairly common in the truth movement, especially among the more sort of buttoned up professional types. And in Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, of course, in that group, the group is dedicated to focusing on the architecture and the engineering and not so much the who did it. But in terms of how one would try to get through to Trump, which frankly I think is probably a hopeless task, this person thinks, no, you want to be very, just talk about the demolitions that might get through to him, but nothing talking about Israel is going to work with him. So why do you think that in writing to Trump, it is, you know, or which do you think is right? I mean, why would it be better to bring up the Israeli stuff, or why would this guy think it would be better to simply focus on the demolitions?
Yeah, thinking on that particular recent communication, he just wants me to tone it down and look at the engineering and why it had to be a controlled demolition and violates Newton's second law of motion. But from my opinion, especially speaking as an attorney and at the very least a U.S. citizen, so what if you're right? So what if it's a total hoax, it's a total lie? If you don't do anything about it, and if you don't go after the people that did it, like Donald Trump said in his initial interview, so what? You know, they'll laugh in your face. They'll be proud of it. It'll be, what do they call it, chutzpah. Yeah, we can get away with it, and you know exactly what we did, and you're not going to do a damn thing about it. And what's more, we're going to do something even worse tomorrow, and it might happen today. So, you know, that's like water off a duck's back there.
Yeah,
some of the people who you're not aware of have verbally cursed me out and called me a racist and anti-Semite, and you better watch the ADLs coming after me.
Right. Yeah, tell me about that.
I just can't let that control my life.
Yeah. Well, isn't it interesting how this amazing firewall has been built up around criticizing this incredibly powerful lobby? You know, and on one hand, it's sort of an ethnic lobby, and parts of it are an ethnic organized crime outfit or series of overlapping outfits. At another level, it's the lobby of a foreign government, and it gets away with murder over and over and over, and anybody who speaks up about it gets insulted.
Yeah. Well, I was at an event this morning with Dana Rohrabacher. He's our local congressman here in Huntington Beach. And I was waiting in line to ask him a question. Another gentleman somebody else had given him my letters. He knew about it, but I didn't recognize him. We got involved in a discussion. He had a foreign accent, and it turns out he's highly educated, speaks five languages, and he's been reading these letters. And he says he wouldn't put it out in public, but he says that the Zionists are like a mafia. They're worse than the mafia. They're international, global mafia people that are out to spread their crime all over the world. And he admired me for writing about that and putting out for the president. And then he left.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I think there are a lot of people out there who have sort of figured this out. You know, I run into such people all the time. But the vast majority don't seem to really want to step up to the plate and, you know, push back against these people. I mean, even if they understand who really did 9/11 and why, that you would think that would be enough of an emotional punch in the gut that people would react by seeking justice. I mean, after 9/11, look at how the whole country was up in arms like a, you know, wasp nest that had been kicked, you know, wanting to go after the perpetrators. And now you figure out who's the real perpetrator, you'd kind of think that there'd still be a little of that, but you know, you don't see it that much.
Psychologically, I've done a bit of litigation, people going through laws, air crash cases, divorces, and things like that. They're commonly recognized, this is maybe about 60 or 70 years, psychologists have and psychiatrists have conducted experiments and studies on the five stages of loss. And denial is the first stage. It could be a few seconds. You could get stuck in denial for the rest of your life. But I think that's the reason. It's so uncomfortable for people to face even the possibility that their government could fail them, because what do they turn to then? They just can't believe that government or that George Bush could even possibly think about being involved in something like that. How could you even do that? It's just blasphemy. But nevertheless, with very strong evidence put in front of them, a few get past that and go on and want to look at more. And fortunately, I'm in the Team Trump and Republican Party. And we've had that experience happen more and more. But some of the ones that are so entrenched, physically, they keep 30 feet from me.
So are you involved in the Republican Party?
Well, I'm the vice president, second vice president here in the Leisure World Republican Party, and if you read back in my early letters, I've been involved with the Team Trump since the beginning.
Right. So have you ever had a chance to actually talk to him or people close to him? We've had a couple others. My main contact in, you know, the Trump people for 9/11 Truth is Rick Shattuck, who was a Trump campaign guy in Iowa. Rick is a great guy. And he had actually had some direct contacts with Donald Trump Jr. and others in the campaign, and some very brief contacts with Trump himself. So have you gotten close to any of those people, and have you gotten any sense of...
Rick Shattuck, I haven't met him, but he was at the family reunion in Oklahoma, Oshkosh, or someplace like that, mm-hmm. and he got into the press box because, you know, Trump controls the press pretty well. He had the press credentials and got in and then asked Trump while they were going there, you know, about the towers, a lot of people have questions about those. Those were very strong, and they have questions how they're coming down. And Trump jumped on it and kind of put him down. Oh, here's a conspiracy guy, you know, laughing at him, at the press, laughing with the press at him. He has a way of doing things like that to intimidate people. But Rick didn't appear to be intimidated. He didn't get obnoxious or disrupt the thing, but he did put it out there. And I wrote about that in one of my early letters to Trump, and I reminded him what he said in the German interview, that what do you do in response to 9/11? Well, the first and most important thing is you find out exactly how it happened and who was behind it, and then you go after those people because we have no choice. And that's what he said. And then to put Rick Shattuck down like that for even bringing it up as a subject, I thought was I wanted to know what changed his mind. And then after that, he spoke in Herndon, Virginia, and somebody else asked him, and he flipped back over. He said, well, he had great problems with 9/11. He said the American people are entitled to know what happened, and he just can't get his head around how especially Building 7, which wasn't even hit by an airplane, came down. And he said, and I don't know if it was that interview or one before and or after, he said that he believed explosives had to be used.
No, really, I must. How did I miss that? Because I know I've seen the interview on 9/11 itself, where he says explosives had to have been used, even just to get the planes to penetrate the buildings that way. So that one's very well known. But the ones you're referring to, where he talks about Building 7 and so on, I don't recall having seen that.
Where he what?
You just described this interview during the campaign where Trump talks basically...
Herndon, Virginia.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in the... actually, I include some photos of him giving the speech. It's in one of the early Trump letters. If you go to the index, you'll see it. I forget what I called it, the American...
Is there a recording of that, though? I mean, a video or an audio?
There was a news report, and I asked the reporter... to verify it a couple times, and I haven't heard back. But it was on World News, I think. I'm trying to find it here.
Maybe if we can pull up, if we can find whatever documentation that we have for that, that would be great.
Well, let me get it here.
And then there's also the story of Martin Hill. He's a friend of mine. He's a paleo-Catholic activist. He's also from Southern California, like you. And Martin is a truck driver, so he gets around, and he went from Trump rally to Trump rally, camping out at night to get front row seats, and he managed to get into the front row in Michigan. I think it was is in Western Michigan. Anyway, so he interrupted Trump in the middle of Trump's speech, and unlike in most cases, Trump actually just stopped. He just froze and stopped in mid-speech as Martin yelled, "Trump, it wasn't dancing Muslims, it was dancing Israelis."
Yeah, that's right. I saw that.
Yeah.
And Trump said that he had him evicted, but he said, take it easy on him. He's one of ours.
Yeah, he's a Trump guy.
Yeah.
so there, some of these incidents like that had me wondering, you know, whether Trump might really be the pro 9/11 truth character that some of my friends seem to think. I mean, I've been a Trump skeptic from the get-go. You know, to me, he looks pretty egotistical and not all that questioning and intellectual or even very bright or literate. So I've really been quite skeptical from the get-go, but I have a lot of friends and Truth Movement colleagues who've had high hopes for him. And I mean, I give the devil his due. So I've reported these things that have given the Truth Movement some hope, and I've taken a lot of flack for it from the left-wingers who hate Trump completely and are not open to it. But frankly, when I read your letters to him, I think, yeah, this would be great if this guy, you know, were even open to looking at this. But I just don't see the evidence that he is.
I don't see any evidence of what?
Well, that he is in the least bit, number one, really particularly curious about even what happened on 9/11 and how the world works. And number two, that he has any desire to try to right this wrong.
Well, I think I've had several conference calls with his attorneys in Washington, and I guess I can talk about this. I told him it's open. You know, I talk openly about it with Don McGahn, who's the chief counsel for Trump at GMC. So they wanted me to go ahead and continue with the monthly letters under this topic. And it came up a couple times with him and several other people, that these are paid people, that this is a very explosive issue. And if I pursue it, it could, on my own, you know, push for him to bring it up before the election, especially, that it's it could turn out to be not a good thing. So I just send them off, and they're keeping a file on it. And I haven't heard anything back bad. I have a couple letters that are signed by Donald Trump, but I assume that they're computer produced, for at least for people in my category. You know, they put your personal name in. I copied them in the, when you get the file of all the letters. And he also sent me a certificate to be on the board of directors after I sent a bonus letter about the upside down stars.
What board of directors?
There's a bonus letter around the turn of the year. It's not strictly about 9/11. They're all about 9/11. This one was a picture of Hillary and Bill Clinton and Chelsea standing there on the stage with the big rally with all the Hillary signs in front and a huge flag, this, you know, the size of a small building wall. And I noticed that the stars were upside down.
That's
so if you look at that letter, you'll see the upside down stars is a sign of the devil, the goat.
Yeah, I've heard and that.
I raised the question in that letter, why would she go to the effort and the expense to produce a huge United States of America flag with the stars upside down? And then right beside it, I had a picture of Donald Trump, you know, making his argument, raising his hand, and he's in front of the flag, and his stars are definitely right side up. And then there's a picture of Betsy Ross showing the first American flag to George Washington. The stars are in a circle, but thank God they're all right side up.
Well, you know, that leads into the topic of to what extent there is a kind of occult or satanic influence at work in, you know, some of these groups and organizations, you know, to what extent the some of the powers that be may be influenced by this. And a whole lot of people believe this. And the more I've researched it, the more I think it's plausible that there are occult groups that have been very active throughout history and have had a lot of influence on history. And I don't think they've gone away. And in particular, the, you know, kind of the elephant in the living room today is the way that Zionism, which originated not as a Jewish secular national liberation movement in the 19th century, as we're told, but rather as a heretical satanic movement led by people like Shabtai Zvi and Jacob Frank centuries earlier. Those were the people who, you know, the false Messiah, Shabtai Zvi, you know, declared himself the Messiah, said it was time to go back and take the Holy Land, even though God didn't do it. You know, traditional Judaism said they wait till God does it, but he said, no, we're going to just go do it now. And the more we can blaspheme and the more we can violate the Ten Commandments and, you know, kill, steal, commit adultery, all that stuff, the more we do that, the more we will force God's hand to bring us this messianic era where we rule the world. So that's the kind of satanic offshoot from Judaism that gives birth to Zionism. And so you don't have to be really particularly paranoid to notice that the lies, the massacres, the horrific things being done in the name of Zionism seem to go too far. I mean, they're so excessive that you can almost see a kind of a metaphysical principle of evil behind it. And then you look at the Freemasons' obsession with rebuilding the blood sacrifice temple in Jerusalem, some of the hardcore Zionists' obsession with rebuilding this blood sacrifice temple and destroying the greatest Islamic architectural monument, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and rebuilding this blood sacrifice temple. It kind of looks like Zionism is basically a satanic movement, and that the long-term aim is to put the Antichrist on the throne in Jerusalem. So I don't know whether you're cognizant of that stuff, but it's a very interesting line of inquiry.
Well, my mind was racing when you were talking. In my years of legal representation, not all of my clientele were the cream of the crop. Some were rather nefarious, but as an attorney, you're professional. You have to do what you're going to do. But I've run across this before, and it's not that they're particularly crazy or fanatical about these pedophilia things. Some groups that may be involved in nefarious affairs like to be able to trust each other, and one of the ways they can trust each other is if they mutually become involved in something like that, like Pizzagate, some of the stuff you see there. Mm-hmm. Because if the loyalty is broken, you can immediately release the documents. It's like hanging yourself if you were to break your loyalty to somebody who went to a pedophilia event with you, and things, especially if things turned out really ghastly. So it's a Machiavellian mechanism that occurs, I think, in natural law, given enough time and the nature of our human nature to greed and things that the devil brings forward. I think there are very, very powerful groups that operate, and they use that for internal control. And as a result of that, they're so loyal to each other, they, over a period of time, they increase their wealth and their control over society. And I'm not an expert on it by any way, any stretch of the imagination, but I think of the what they call the Illuminati and these events they go to. There was recently one in Colorado. And they have a ritual proceeding there. I don't know if it's a sacrifice or whatever. But thanks to the internet now, a lot of these things are coming to light. If you put it in there, that Abramoff lady who puts on these events, are you familiar with her?
No, this is the Colorado event you mentioned?
I don't know what happened at the Colorado event, but I do know, or I heard that Jacob Rothschild was there, and also Jeff Rothschild.
Okay.
And some of the stuff, it takes a while for it to surface. They have a ritual ceremony with the upside down stars and the goat head, and blood ceremonies with infants, and a full size human body in a vat of blood, and it looks just like a naked lady. And it turns out it was a cake that was especially made, so when you cut it open, it even had the organs coming out, and they cut up the cake and they ate it all.
That's pretty sick and twisted.
There were a group of some famous people, and I found out it cost them $25,000 a plate.
Oh my goodness. you can't make this stuff up, and call me a crazed radical Islamic fundamentalist, but I think Western civilization is pretty decadent.
Well, yeah. This morning, Dana Rohrabacher referred several times to radical Islamic terrorism. And you'll see in my letters, I think if somebody's going to talk about radical Islamic terrorism, they ought to also recognize Zionist Israeli terrorism.
Well, yeah, Zionism has been, you know, they introduced terrorism to the region. It's the which was it? Was it Begin or Sharon who bragged that, you know, we invented terrorism?
Yeah, they're proud of it. It's part of chutzpah. It's part of the. It originated in Babylon, and there was an assemblage of letters and writings by various rabbis. Some of them weren't rabbis, but if you look into the Talmud, which was generated a long time ago, when the basically I think parallel to when the Bible was being generated, but it was you know, a pagan society. It adopted Machiavellian principles about who they were and who the Goyim were, and that the Goyim were to be taken advantage of. It's okay to kill Goyim. They're nothing but cattle. You know, you should intentionally deceive them. If you steal something from them, you don't have to give it back. It's very unfair. And that some of that worked its way in is parallel to the Holy Bible, for example, in Exodus, where God promises to Abraham and these words, and his seed, which who knows that who that is, but you think that's Semitic people or the tribes of Abraham. Semitic is Shem. I may be beyond my expertise here, but anyhow, ostensibly, if you just go back, and I have these sites in one of the recent letters to Trump in the Bible in Exodus, I think it's Exodus, God gave Abraham and his seed all the land, and, you know, talking about the rivers and the great water, and anywhere that a Jew walks and the sole of the Jew's foot touches the land, that God has given him and his seed. So that means the whole earth. I asked, well, when Benjamin Netanyahu comes into his home in Trump Tower and his sole of his foot gets off the elevator and sets foot in that magnificent suite up there, does that become Bibi's home?
Or I think it already has.
Don't get to keep it. And likewise, at the United Nations and even our own Congress, when, you know, the Prime Minister from Israel can come into Congress and just basically snub the president. Does that indicate that he owns our Congress?
Right. And how come so many, you know, American patriots don't get this, and they basically are siding with their own oppressor and occupier?
Well, you know, in the American Revolution, there were the Tories, known as the Tories. They just couldn't get in with the real truth. Because I think my ancestors grew up at the time, they were here before the American Revolution. Some of them fought in it, and it's really a divided opinion. And you know, looking at the five stages of loss and getting into denial, sometimes people get so entrenched that it becomes a psychosis, that anything that challenges their denial of what is hitting them in the head is perceived as a threat. And they can get belligerent about it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me that the Arab and Muslim world has been a lot harder to subdue in certain ways than the U.S. has. You know, the U.S. has been really taken over by stealth over a few generations, maybe several generations. If you go back to the Federal Reserve coup d'etat of 1913 and, you know, dragging the U.S. into the world wars and so on. But it seems to me that with the Liberty affair in 67, and well, maybe the JFK assassination before that, and then the Liberty affair, you know, that shifted power in a certain direction, and that 9/11 was kind of the culmination of this process that was really a kind of a hardline neocon Zionist coup d'etat in America, and they've largely owned the place since then. And over in the Arab and Muslim world, people are very aware of these things, and to some extent, some of them fight back and try to defend their own interests. But here in the U.S., it seems that the very few people who are fighting back and telling the truth and trying to defend their country are extremely marginalized, and there really isn't that much of a kind of a central sort of, you know, patriotic American resistance to this Zionist takeover. I guess Pat Buchanan would sort of represent an element of the U.S. society that is aware of these things and fighting back. But it seems that they've managed to do it by stealth better here in the U.S. In the Middle East, they've done it so blatantly, everybody sees what's being done. And here, a lot of people don't seem to see it.
Well, that's true. In the Talmud, their motto, which was adopted by the Mossad and only recently taken off their printed material, it says, "By deception, wage war."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's quite a motto. It was "By way of deception, thou shalt do war."
Right. Yeah. And all these wars, in my opinion, start with false flags, which are a high form of deception.
Mm-hmm. But of course, they're not the only ones that do that.
No, well, that's how all wars tend to start. Because I don't think people inherently like wars. I think it's people that see that they have a particular thing they can win. Kings are notorious for liking wars, as are presidents, because they have somewhat unbridled power. Mm-hmm. But normal people, the people that have to fight and die in them, I don't think they really like war. They get something happens like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or the Reichstag before the invasion of Poland. And people get their superego gets involved, and anything for the country, sign me up. But that's what it takes to get them to sign up. Otherwise, they don't sign up. That's what was put in the RAD, Rebuild America's Defenses document, in the wake of the Project for New American Century documents. That all their goals for taking over the world, and the United States and Israel being the only superpower, that it wouldn't happen in the foreseeable future absent a cataclysmic and crystallizing event like a new Pearl Harbor,
right,
which is exactly what they got, I think, almost exactly to a year after they wrote that.
That's right. And
if you go back behind, follow that chain of documents, beginning with the Clean Break document.
Yeah, I do talk about that, and sometimes, including, I think I went over this in the Left Forum, where I actually would start the process by going back to the 1979 Jerusalem Conference on International Terrorism, the JCIT, where they drafted the plan to replace the Cold War enemy of communism with a new enemy of Islam and terrorism. And then Netanyahu put out a couple of books based on the papers at that conference, and the most important paper there was delivered by the Orientalist Supreme, Bernard Lewis. And the title of that paper, which is collected in the Bibi Netanyahu book, Terrorism, How the West Can Win, which is an amazing title. It's saying that the way the West can beat Islam is through terrorism. and Bernard Lewis's contribution is entitled Islamic Terrorism? ? And on the surface, that essay simply points out that there really isn't any connection between Islam and terrorism. Beneath the surface, what it's proposing is creating false flag Islamic terrorism. That's creating a problem of Islamic terrorism. So that's where it starts. And then we fast forward to the Clean Break document of 1996. And here we have the PNAC crew putting out this plan to help Israel not only defeat its enemies, but transcend them by totally, destroying the Middle East, changing all the borders and so on and so forth. And then PNAC comes along in 2000 and rewrites that Clean Break document as if this is really about helping the American empire, which is, of course, a joke. It's really about expanding the Israeli empire, but they had to sell it to the American generals and military strategists, so they rewrote it in the key of American supremacy. So that's my take on this document.
I admire you. You're pretty well-versed in that.
Yeah, well, I've been focusing on this stuff since, since 2004 when I first woke up to 9/11. And then in 2006, they witch hunted me out of my position at the University of Wisconsin and destroyed any chance for a conventional academic career here in the USA. So I've had nothing better to do since then but work on this stuff.
Fortunately for me, I'm at the end of a legal, not the end yet. I'm still actively practicing. I still get paid to do cases, so I can be somewhat independent and, exercise independent professional judgment. It seems in my background, I have not only law, but in architecture and construction, but also aerospace. I spent some time at Hughes Space and Communications on real estate and satellite projects, and then I, when I went on my own, I passed the bar and opened my office. The first paying case that came in was an air crash case, the DC-10 that crashed outside of Paris in 74.
Huh, interesting. So
and then, yeah. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I was wondering about your experience with that related to the, you know, the air crashes of 9/11, and what was really going on with those crashes.
Well, I remember watching it on TV. I assume as it was happening, but I think a lot of that was clips that were played after the fact that may have been edited.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of, and I also have a substantial experience with high-rise towers, most famous of which is the Transamerica Tower, the pyramid in San Francisco.
Really? You worked on that?
Yeah, I worked for William Ferrer at the time. I was the lowest of five guys on the totem pole. I was the rookie, but I spent 90 hours a week working on it.
Really? That's interesting. You know, that was on the cover of my first book. My first ever book was a self-published money-making project in San Francisco called Dr. Weird's Weird Tours, A Guide to Mysterious San Francisco. So it's a bunch of weird legends about San Francisco, the places where bizarre things happened in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
And so I put the Transamerica Pyramid with an eye in the pyramid on the cover.
But anyhow, I mean, even before they hit the first building hit the ground, I knew that airplanes couldn't do that. And both from my experience as having done air crash litigation, and also as an architect with experience on high rise construction, and an airplane cannot bring down a steel tower. First of all, it's just a matter of the mass. The plane is physically not heavy enough, even fully loaded with fuel, to knock down the steel structure, because the steel structure is designed with a safety factor for wind and earthquake load, which far exceed the force that can be generated by an air crash.
Mm-hmm.
And that was even demonstrated in the 40s. A B-52 hit the Empire State Building, and it put a gash in the side. But, you know, a B-52 is a sizable plane, not like a 767. But no way was the structural integrity affected at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, as I watched the exploding powder, which I assumed was asbestos and lightweight concrete in the metal deck floors,
mm-hmm.
I was just astounded to think that they would even be saying that an airplane caused it.
And
then as time went on, I assumed, you know, they're going to have an investigation and find out it speaks for itself. But it never happened. They just got covered up. And we had Robert Mueller, who came in and assumed his duties as the director of FBI, I think it was a week before 9/11, and stayed on for, I think, just under 13 years. And during his time as director of the FBI, he prevented any investigation.
Well, and you pointed out in your letter to Trump that, you know, if Mueller goes after Trump too hard, Trump could threaten to expose 9/11, which Mueller is obviously complicit in.
Well, I actually told Trump in that letter, you can't threaten because that would be extortion.
Just do it.
When you get an extortion situation, you don't threaten, you just do it.
Just do it.
And I think it's past time that it's done and that it's started. So Mueller, you know, he prevented an investigation while 24/7 they were carting off the evidence and chopping it up in little pieces and mixing it with other waste, construction waste, and selling to China when the price of the steel was at the lowest. It is a classic example of destruction of crime scene evidence. And to the best of my senses, I can't understand how these politicians will say, well, Robert Mueller is behind reproach, he's a man of integrity, and he's definitely qualified, he's no problems with Mueller. It's like, oh my God, what do you see what this guy did? And
yeah.
Then likewise with Rudy Giuliani, who was in the running for Secretary of State for a while, you'll see in the early letters, Rudy Giuliani is on record, videoed, saying that he was informed the towers were going to collapse ahead of time.
That's right. Well, that's how We Are Change knocked him out of the race in, I think it was, 2008 maybe? When he was running for president, the We Are Change people were following him around everywhere he went, and yelling at him, how come you didn't warn the firefighters? If you knew that the towers were coming down ahead of time, why didn't you warn them? And then he denied it and said, no, I didn't know the towers were coming home. And so then the We Are Change people pulled up that video where he's talking on 9/11 itself, admitting that they left Building 7 and went over to this backup command center precisely because they were warned ahead of time that the towers were coming down.
Right. And, you know, he didn't act to save anybody except himself and his own friends that went across Barclay Street to makeshift offices after they had just spent hundreds of millions of dollars on what he called Rudy's bunker in Building 7. I mean, why wouldn't they be operating out of Building 7? Well, I've recently figured that out. It's significant that Building 7 didn't come down until 5:20 in the afternoon. So they had about a little more than five hours, if they were really running 9/11 out of his bunker in Building 7. Then after things are settled down a bit, then they demolish Building 7, and that gets rid of any evidence of the site where it was coordinated in Rudy's bunker. That's just my suspicion.
It's possible. Have you looked into the stories about Barry Jennings and Michael Hess being in Building 7 and witnessing huge pre-demolition explosions before the planes hit the towers, and, you know, being pulled out by firefighters, stepping over dead bodies on the way out. And Barry Jennings apparently was killed for having talked about this stuff right at the same time that the NIST Building 7 report came out. BBC did a hit piece on the truth movement to coincide with the Building 7 report, and they did a attempt to ruin Jennings' reputation, you know, at the same moment that he had been murdered. And then the We Are Change guys who had interviewed Jennings hired an investigator to try to find out what happened to Jennings, and the guy came back and returned his sizable retainer fee, saying this is way above my pay grade, you know, looking white as a sheet. So anyway, that all would suggest that something, they were you know, blowing up a lot of Building 7, doing pre-demolition explosions that morning, which leads you to, well, in that case, it sounds like the Jennings and Hess were up there on the 23rd floor in the command bunker. And they got there and they said that it was empty and there, you know, there was steaming coffee on the table. Right. It looked like it had been hastily abandoned. They got on the phone and they were told, get out of there right now. So they headed down the stairs and boom, these massive pre-demolition explosions started. So if that's the case, then your thesis that they ran 9/11 out of there wouldn't really make sense, because it sounds like they evacuated before that.
Well, I don't know. As I mentioned, that thought just recently arrived to my thinking, but I don't really settle down to the point where I'm willing to offer an opinion until I've what I call triangulated the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at the evidence for what actually happened on these planes, these passenger aircraft? There's all sorts of contradictory evidence. I mean, the one thing we know is that the official story obviously didn't happen, but what did? You know, why was there why was this Israeli Special Forces guy on Flight 11, Danny Lewin, you know, one of the top Special Forces guys, and as well as a, you know, 180 IQ computer genius that could, you know, kill you with his bare hands in a microsecond. You know, what was this guy doing sitting right behind Mohammed Atta, I think it was, and you know, his seat was the seat that the Betty On Call says that's where the hijacker was. So what do you think happened on these planes?
Well, as far as the hijackers, I think there's enough corroborating evidence from multiple sources that most of them were alive after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
That means they weren't on the planes, and their names don't appear on the passenger list or anything connected with them on the flight manifest.
Right.
And also, there's no videos of them going through security. That one video of Atta is in Portland, Maine, and it's not even the one where it's alleged he was getting on the hijack plane.
Yeah, in Boston, the plane was hijacked out of Boston, and there's no video of that. There's no authentic video of any of these guys getting on any of the planes.
And also, the planes, when it's tracked down, let's hear, as a professor I saw an interview, he went to the time through the, he's got access to the records of where they keep track of every manufactured plane by serial number, and there are three numbering systems. And those four planes weren't on the proper list as far as being the planes associated with those four flights on 9/11, which is very unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Even after when Boeing, or I assume Lockheed, sells a plane, they keep track of it throughout its whole existence, independent of the operator. So they've got a system, I think it's in St. Louis, globally keeps track of a lot of real-time data from all of their planes.
Yeah, there have been contradictory reports. Pilots for 9/11 Truth has gotten into some of this, you know, various reports that two of the flights were not even scheduled that day, that two of the planes were flying around for years later, the same tail numbers. And, of course, there's been a conspicuous lack of authentic crash debris, and the FBI walled off each alleged crash site. Well, there wasn't much left at the towers, of course, but at Shanksville, the FBI came in and made sure the NTSB could not do its normal post-crash reconstruction. And the same thing, apparently, at the Pentagon, the NTSB was not allowed in there either. So there's really no evidence that these were actual plane crashes at the advertised locations.
Those are the only, I'm familiar with air crash procedures, and that's the only cases where the NTSB was not allowed to do an investigation, which is highly unusual.
Yeah.
And also, I've been to several plane crash sites, and I've seen a lot of photographic evidence. And it's amazing when a big jet crashes, their body's in it, there's blood. People have a lot of blood in them, and it's under pressure. And when they get hit, there's a mass traumatic injury to the body, and they explode. It's what is called avulsion. They explode out of their skin, and their skin is kind of like this one I saw in the forest outside of Paris. It looked like wetsuit bodies hanging from these decimated giant pine trees, and it was the skin that was where the bodies had been avulsed out of it due to the explosive force. There was none of that in Shanksville.
Mm-hmm. There was nothing much there at all in Shanksville.
Drop of blood. Pardon?
Nothing much at all at Shanksville, the alleged crash site.
My opinion is that was some sort of a missile that hit and exploded.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the planes, I'm also a member of the Video Producers Club here, so I have the editing hardware. I've looked at those video clips of the planes crash, and particularly the second crash, and at first blush, like Dana Rohrabacher said, didn't you look at the videos? There's clearly planes hitting the building. Well, you look at that, and there's one very famous clip where the plane is coming in. It's the second strike, and there's a building about a half a mile away from the World Trade Center, and the plane is coming in at a slight angle, and its wing and tail go behind the building in the video.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that the plane would have had to been a half a mile at least away from the tower that it hit just before it hit. And then there's also, I forget whether it's the same plane, but it's a separate video. The plane is coming through, and just before it strikes, there's a crane with a boom and a cable hanging down. And whoever took the video clip was behind the crane, and you have the plane coming in, and it goes in front of the boom and behind the cable, so the plane would have had to have diverted its path and come over to the crane, which is closer to the camera, and fly between the boom and the cable, and then go back over and hit the building, which you just,
uh-huh.
If you're doing computer graphic imagery, that's, you know, just a little bit of sloppiness, but in reality, it just could not possibly happen.
So you think these are CGI fake videos? I mean, some people have hypothesized holograms. I mean, what's your take on this?
Right. And then also, in doing editing with motion,
mm-hmm.
You can establish a framework, like for the building. But if you, for example, if you're working with an original clip from a helicopter, a helicopter is bouncing around up there. Even with the camera stabilization, it's still moving. And I looked at that where the plane comes through the second plane, and it appears to be entering one side of the building, and a split second later, the nose, which is sheet aluminum and fiberglass, comes out fully intact for 5 feet on the outside of the building and then disappears.
Yeah, I've seen that. That is pretty suspicious.
Yeah. And it turns out that due to the motion of the helicopter on the original frame, they set the frame right at the vertical line of the building. And by the time the plane hits it and comes out, the camera had moved a little bit, so the plane didn't know to disappear until it was outside of the building, which proves to me beyond a doubt those were edited in, and that never really happened.
Interesting.
And then there's more evidence that when you track these planes up, they're flying around for more than an hour. The whole episode's more than an hour. And not being intercepted or anything by our multi-trillion dollar defense system, who were called out by Dick Cheney as part of a NORAD exercise. But they're flying around out there, and coincidentally, at least two or three of them actually flew over military air bases, not commercial airflight.
Yeah, I think Stewart Air Force Base in upstate New York was one, right?
Right, and they... this is a theory that military drones, airplanes, but nobody in them, they're flown remotely, paralleled the flights of the real planes with passengers in them. And on the radar screen, it would, you know, it's jerky. They don't have real-time planes flying around there. It would jerk from one view of the plane, which is one of the passengers, and the next jerk, it's a military plane. And the passenger plane goes and lands someplace else, I suspect at a military base.
Yeah, I know people like my friend Ken Jenkins in California, shout out to Ken, who is adamantly opposed to this kind of speculation. And I think it's mainly because he feels he's reverse engineered this project in his mind. And he thinks, you know, if I were hired to do this job, the simple way to do it would be to remote hijack and remote fly actual commercial airliners. So all of the plane switching would just make it too complicated and so on. You know, trying to fake videos, all of this would be unnecessary complication. The easy way to do the project would be just to fly, you know, remote control, fly commercial airliners into these targets.
True. That's why I said it's just a theory, because I'm using the scientific method. I like to have a number of theories that I can compare and contrast between them as the evidence.
Right. Well, so sometimes my response to Ken is that, okay, that's how you, an engineer, would remote engineer this. But the people who did this may not have had the same kind of approach that you would take. We do see over and over that these people, these secret society in Intel agency oriented people doing these big jobs, you know, they do it in a bigger and fancier way than might strictly be necessary. You know, they could have just poisoned JFK's toothpaste, but no, they had to go and, you know, have like, you know, at least, you know, eight shooters for at least four separate shooter teams out there in Dallas. They sent every bad guy in the world to Dallas. They had all the top guys meeting in Dallas the night before. They, you know, and then they went and they whacked Oswald with Jack Ruby, the known, you know, Zionist mob hitman, real name Rubenstein, all this stuff. They did it in such an extremely Baroque way that wasn't necessary. The same thing could be true for 9/11. And so, you know, when you've eliminated all the impossibilities, you know, whatever is left has to be what's true. And frankly, it looks to me like this kind of plane swap or, you know, extreme Baroque deception hypothesis that you're talking about has a lot of evidence backing it up.
Right. Yeah, it's just one theory, but the fact that it's a theory has to have some supporting backup evidence, and then, you know, the chips will fall where they may. Unfortunately, that can't happen until we have a real independent professional investigation with integrity, which is, I made that clear since I started writing to Donald Trump, that he's the only candidate that we had any hope of having an investigation.
Well, maybe the best way that could happen would be, you know, if the anti-Trump movement keeps, you know, pushing so hard that Trump is really stuck between a rock and a hard place, you know, maybe this will, you know, it could happen as a kind of a last-ditch defense for Trump.
Could. You never know how politics plays out. I can't second-guess him. In order to keep it nice, as simple and understandable as I can, I'm a single-issue guy. That's 9/11 truth. All this stuff is about 9/11 truth. And at least they haven't shut me down, and they've been very receptive and positive about it.
That's interesting in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, if I were Trump, I'd be very careful who I talked with, particularly if I don't know somebody like me out of the blue, he doesn't know who I am. He'd have to have people check me out, and I'd have to consent and sign maybe non-disclosure forms or whatever. So he doesn't want to talk with somebody like me because I might be out there, I might record him or, quote him, and it wouldn't look good. So before he does that, he has his people filter out who he's going to expose himself to, and that's fully understandable.
What happens if this works? If somehow, at some level, somebody with enough leverage decides to go ahead and expose this thing, which really is an existential issue for the Zionists, how are they going to respond to
it? Well, they're in it all out. They figure I think that they're really Machiavelli in their approach to things. This has been going on for a long time, and they bet the farm on it. Because like Alan Sobrowski, he's from the Army War College.
Yeah.
He's a PhD. He says it's all up. If people realize, he said this in several public forums, that Israel did 9/11, it's over for Israel. It's very unfortunate, but I separate out Israel from Jews. My great grandfather was Jewish. No matter how Jewish I am, if I went over and took advantage of it, the right of return to Israel, and killed the people that were living there or drove them off or whatever, and then got their wealth, I think that's like Hitler going into Poland. He brought back the treasure trove from invading a foreign country based upon a false flag attack on the Reichstag and brought the wealth back to Germany. So he was immensely popular. And those people that profited from that, they disclaimed any knowledge about what was going on in Poland or Austria or these other places, France. And they were enjoying the good life. So I'm sorry. I don't sympathize with Jews that went over there and basically are benefiting from genocide. But Jews, particularly Jews that are against that, and you see in the last letter, I've got a number of photographs of Jewish groups objecting to Zionists. They're my heroes. They're on the front lines. They're standing up to it. I can sit back here in my gated community and write these things and, take my chances. But hell, if I were a Jew in Israel, I put up a sign like that, the IDF comes over and arrests me. You can see photographs on it. They beat themselves up over.
Well, this. Rabbi Weiss was on my show shortly after the Mavi Marmara incident, and he was planning to be on that ship. And then they told him that the IDF was likely to intercept the ship and that his name would be likely on the assassination list. So the Turkish authorities...
He's Rabbi Weiss, it's in my letter.
Yeah, he's the Naturi Karta guy, the Jews against Zionism. So the Turks wouldn't allow him to get on the Mavi Marmara, which probably saved his life. He said that his predecessor was murdered by the Zionists. So yeah, these guys are pretty brave.
Yeah, my approach to life is I'm 75 now. I've had a good life. I haven't accomplished everything I wanted, but I've been dual professions for 43 years. I've never been involved in any discipline actions or scandals or crimes. I got arrested once for a civil rights demonstration when I was in college, but I was never arrested for anything else. I've been through that, and I figure I can. The best thing I'm in a position now to give back is my patriotism, because I look at the response of 9/11, and frankly, I feel that our nation has lost its spine. Everybody is running around like little mice or rats in a maze, trying to pay their bills and keep their jobs and their medical care and to get their kids educated, but they're selling their souls to do it, because an attack like 9/11 is really an attack on the soul of our nation, on our civilization, and to become just psychologically involved in this denial of it to the point where you not only don't do anything about it, you don't even recognize it, just invites more of what this enemy hungers for.
And so if they can get away with this, they can get away with anything, and they'll keep on doing it. Well, I think we're at the end of the hour, David. But thank you.
Okay.
It's been a really wonderful conversation, and I appreciate your great work. I'd love to have you back for more at some point.
Okay.
God willing.
Well, we both have pretty good spirits. I'll cooperate. And can you send me a link to my email so I can just click on the link and listen to the interview?
Yes, I'll send you a link when it's up. It'll be
okay.
Available by way. People can find all my stuff at truthjihad.com. Click on the radio link, and you'll find your way there. Well, thank you, David Dumble. I appreciate it. Keep up the great work.
Do I have time to mention one more thing?
Okay.
If somebody wants to receive the BCC copies of the Trump letters, I only send them to people who request it. You have to request it by emailing me, david@davidnoble.com. That's N-O-B-L-E, david@davidnoble.com. Then I put you on the list. Anybody objects to them and doesn't want to receive them, I take it off right away.
Okay, it's good stuff, folks. Okay, thank you, David.
Perfect.
Much appreciated.
Thank you, Kevin.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.